Señoras, señores, queridos amigos, el ciclo de conferencias que sobre la nueva biología hemos ido manteniendo en la Fundación en todos estos lunes del mes de mayo. Precisamente el título general del ciclo, la nueva biología, es el título de la conferencia que va a pronunciar hoy el doctor Sidney Brenner y que nos sirvió de guía para orientar la generalidad de nuestra organización de las conferencias. El doctor Sidney Brenner está ya con nosotros. Es el actual director del Medical Research Council inglés y va a ser presentado no solamente en su aspecto biográfico, sino también en el contenido científico de sus investigaciones por el profesor Carlos Asensio, catedrático de bioquímica en la Facultad de Medicina de la Universidad de Alcalá de Henares. Como siempre, mis palabras tratan simplemente de señalar cuál va a ser el orden del acto, sin extenderme más, pero siendo esta la última ocasión, quiero también agradecerles a todos ustedes, sobre todo a la mayor parte de ustedes que han seguido con asiduidad este ciclo de conferencias, su presencia en la Fundación, el interés que han desplegado al seguir estas conferencias, que nos estimula mucho a los organizadores y a los responsables de esta casa para sucesivas iniciativas parecidas a la que hoy concluye aquí. Buenas tardes, pues, a todos. Muchas gracias. Cedo el uso de la palabra al doctor Asensio. Inmediatamente después será el profesor Brenner el que clausure este ciclo. Buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes a todos. En primer lugar, quiero expresar mi agradecimiento a la Fundación Juan Mars y a su director, gerente José Luis Yuste, por haberme permitido el privilegio de presentar a un científico tan eminente como el doctor Sidney Brenner. Esta distinguida audiencia, estoy seguro que sabe perfectamente que tratar de presentar a doctor Brenner es casi tan pretencioso como comprometido. Para establecer un paralelo vivido por mí hace poco más de un año, les diré que tuve otro privilegio parecido cuando se me encomendó que presentase, juzguen ustedes, al profesor Severo Ochoa. Mi primera reacción fue decir, ¿presentar a quién? Y menos mal que no fue en su Luarca natal, fue en Madrid. Y lo primero que hice fue, naturalmente, excusarme ante él y seguidamente agradecerle por honestidad elemental, el que, en cierto modo, era él el que me presentaba a mí. Y con los debidos matices, estoy ahora en circunstancias muy parecidas. El doctor Sidney Brenner es de origen sudafricano, en donde hizo los estudios de medicina. Luego, con una beca de su gobierno, hizo el doctorado en la Universidad de Oxford, en Inglaterra. Durante su estancia en Oxford, tuvo ocasión de conocer a una pareja de científicos singulares que ahora nos parecen casi una pareja mítica, Watson y Crick. Inmediatamente, estos dos científicos se percataron de la excepcional valía de este joven científico. Justamente conocieron a Brenner cuando acababan de descifrar la estructura del ácido desoxirribonucleico, el material hereditario, el famoso DNA. Después de Oxford, Brenner regresó a su país de origen, en donde estuvo dos años como profesor en su universidad original. Pero la atmósfera era asfixiante. El provincialismo científico y la estrechez de miras de sus políticos, amén de otras dificultades, le hacían insoportable la estancia por más tiempo allí, después de su experiencia inglesa. Y finalmente terminó por volver a Cambridge con la ayuda entusiasta de Francis Crick. Comienza así una fecunda asociación de varios años entre los dos científicos, tan estrecha y cordial que de hecho compartieron el mismo despacho con tan solo una gran pizarra de por medio. Y esta estrecha asociación duró hasta la marcha de Crick a California en el año 1976. De esta forma, Brenner entró en el llamado círculo mágico, que es indudablemente la élite promotora de la biología molecular de nuestro tiempo. Podríamos decir que esta nueva disciplina se fraguó en aproximadamente 2 docenas de centros de excelencia repartidos entre Estados Unidos y Europa Occidental. Pero son 4, fundamentalmente 4, los centros más señalados en donde estaba realmente el caldo nutricio del círculo mágico. Y estos centros, 2 de ellos están en Estados Unidos. Uno de ellos en el laboratorio de Cold Spring Harbor, cerca de Nueva York, y el otro, la división de biología, en el Instituto Tecnológico de California, al otro extremo. Y ambas son como la Medina y la Meca de la biología molecular norteamericana. Los otros 2 centros en Europa, uno es el Instituto Pasteur en París, y el otro, justamente el otro, es el laboratorio de biología molecular de Cambridge, cuyo director desde 1979 es precisamente el doctor Sidney Brenner. De los 4 centros, yo pondría en primer lugar, por su excelencia y por sus contribuciones a la nueva biología, al Centro de Biología Molecular de Cambridge, en donde han desarrollado su labor, entre otros, los premios Nobel Crick, Perutz, Kendrew y Sanger. Y allí trabaja también, como saben ustedes, el último conferenciante de este ciclo, el doctor César Mistein, que dio la conferencia en este ciclo de la Fundación Juan Mars, ciclo que hoy cierra precisamente el doctor Brenner. El doctor Brenner no va a hablar mayormente de su propio trabajo en esta conferencia, y por ello me voy a permitir hacer una mención forzosamente fugaz de sus extraordinarios logros científicos. Su trabajo tiene 2 etapas bien diferenciadas. La primera comprende una década, aproximadamente a caballo entre los años 50 y 60, enteramente dedicada al esclarecimiento de los mecanismos moleculares de la expresión del mensaje genético. Más concretamente, el desciframiento de la clave genética o alfabeto de la vida, como también se le llama, que fue sin duda alguna el desafío más apasionante para los biólogos moleculares de aquel gran periodo. Las contribuciones hoy clásicas de Brenner en este campo fueron sumamente originales, profundas y decisivas para el desentrañamiento de la clave genética, e incluyen el descubrimiento del codón como triplete o unidad codificadora de cada aminoácido de las cadenas polipeptídicas y el carácter no solapante y exento de comas de este triplete. Pido por anticipado perdón porque necesariamente tengo que usar un lenguaje un poco técnico, al menos en esta breve descripción. Otra contribución de mayor cuantía fue el descubrimiento o la determinación de la secuencia de bases de los 3 tripletes de la clave genética llamados sin sentido, es decir, los únicos tripletes de la clave que no codifican para aminoácidos y que sirven para terminar la biosíntesis de las cadenas proteicas. También debo citar aquí el descubrimiento de la base molecular de las llamadas mutaciones supresoras intragénicas, que fue un enigma sumamente paradójico por muchos años, y que Brenner demostró que se debía a una mutación del anticodón de ciertos ácidos ribonucleicos de transferencia, lo cual provoca el reconocimiento de codones que por otra mutación previa se habían convertido en codones sin sentido. Para terminar con esta primera etapa de su trabajo, debo mencionar otro experimento antológico realizado en 1960. Y sus autores fueron el británico Brenner, el francés Jacob y el norteamericano Meselson. El experimento fue diseñado previamente en una sesión de alto voltaje ocurrida precisamente en la casa de Brenner de Cambridge, precisamente el Viernes Santo de aquel año de 1960. Y el resultado de este experimento, de típica colaboración internacional, fue la confirmación de la existencia del RNA mensajero, que había sido propuesto poco antes por Jacob y Monod, como elemento intermediario entre el programa genético del DNA y la síntesis final de las proteínas. Hacia el final de los años 60, el doctor Brenner estimó que los procesos bioquímicos de la expresión genética estaban básicamente esclarecidos y reorientó su laboratorio para abordar el reto capital de la biología molecular de los años subsiguientes hasta nuestros días. El estudio de los mecanismos moleculares implicados en los procesos de diferenciación y desarrollo de los organismos pluricelulares. El proceso de generación de un organismo completo desde una sola célula, generalmente microscópica, para formar una mosca o una hormiga o un ser humano, constituye un milagro de cada día que en rigor no debe dejar de pasmarnos por su prodigiosa precisión e inventiva. ¿Cuáles son los mecanismos bioquímicos que subyacen y dan cuenta de tales prodigios? La estrategia inicial de Brenner, actualmente sumergido de lleno en este programa, fue la de seleccionar un sistema biológico relativamente sencillo, un minúsculo gusano nematodo apenas visible al ojo humano, que tiene unas características muy ventajosas, como son, entre otras, su rápido crecimiento y unos sistemas de reproducción, de alimentación y conservación relativamente elementales. Además, tiene muy pocas células. Concretamente, la hembra tiene exactamente 853 células, de las cuales aproximadamente 300 son neuronas y 95 son células musculares. Esta relativa simplicidad ha permitido por primera vez la descripción del desarrollo total de un organismo pluricelular siguiendo el destino de cada célula individual. Además, han puesto de manifiesto la diferenciación de linajes celulares postembrionarios según un sistema binario, bajo la intervención de ciertos genes controladores. Por otro lado, han desarrollado unos métodos de exploración sumamente ingeniosos para analizar las bases moleculares de la genética y el funcionamiento de ciertas proteínas complejas, como son las proteínas contráctiles de la locomoción del nematodo. Pero de esto nos va a hablar probablemente el propio Brenner. En conjunto, podemos decir que los estudios del Dr. Brenner, de su grupo y de otros sobre este pequeño gusano, junto con los que utilizan la mosca drosophila, están aportando la información más relevante e incisiva sobre los sumamente complejos mecanismos del desarrollo biológico. La elevada creatividad científica del Dr. Sidney Brenner es el resultado de una personalidad sumamente dotada para la investigación biológica en su rango más elevado. Concurren en él, aparte de sus quilates intelectuales, una poderosa imaginación, un conocimiento profundo de los conceptos genéticos más abstractos y una extraordinaria habilidad como experimentalista. Por todo ello se le considera y se le reconoce como uno de los más grandes biólogos moleculares de nuestro tiempo. Para terminar, deseo expresar mi agradecimiento a los doctores Antonio García Bellido y Ginés Morata y también al British Council por la información que me han proporcionado generosamente sobre la labor y la personalidad del doctor Brenner. Finalmente, deseo transmitirles un mensaje que recibí esta mañana del doctor Julio Rodríguez Villanueva, desde Salamanca. Lamentando no poder estar aquí esta tarde por razones irresolubles, me rogó les dijese que el doctor Sidney Brenner fue el maestro más brillante y más popular durante sus años de estancia en Cambridge. Yo estoy seguro que este mensaje lo vamos a corroborar ahora todos, en directo, escuchando sus propias palabras.
Thank you very much for that most extensive introduction. I had to keep on checking whether I was the right person here tonight. So we'll leave it till the end of the lecture. Perhaps I am, you will discover I'm just an imposter and the real Sidney Brenner is still going to come next week. I have been given a very difficult task tonight to round off the series of lectures of four by giving you a very general view of the subject of the new biology, as we call it. First of all, I would like to thank the Fundación Juan March for bringing me here and to give me this opportunity to talk to a general audience about this very important subject. Alas, I cannot talk to you in Spanish. I only speak two languages, English and rubbish, as you will hear. But I understand I'm being translated simultaneously, and since statistics show there are 40% more syllables in Spanish to communicate the same words, I shall speak slowly and hope that the young lady there will be able to keep up with me. Well, as I said before, I am the last in the series, and my job is to give you an overview of the whole subject. There is a great excitement in modern biology, not only for what it tells us about ourselves and all the living things that inhabit this earth, but also for the possibility that this knowledge offers us for transforming the living world, and the potential it gives us for solving many of the complex problems of a more general kind that face the world in the areas of health, food, energy, and many others as well. As many of you know, since the dawn of time, man has refused to accept his biological adaptation as the end of how he would evolve, but has used his brain and many other activities to improve his advantages over other biological elements by altering his environment. That is the whole rise of technology that has happened over the whole of recorded history, and which brings us to the situation that we find ourselves today. There are now new alternatives open towards us, namely that we may be able to alter in a directed manner the nature of living things themselves, and that will change what is a very old subject and which has been continued mainly by trial and error methods. This subject, as you know, the capacity to alter the nature of living things, has been called genetic engineering. And part of my job here tonight is to prove to you that genetic engineering doesn't exist. That's very interesting, because you see there is still a whole subject to discover. And so what I'd like to do tonight is really a lecture that falls into three parts. First, outline very briefly and very superficially the general ideas of molecular biology that lead us to the understanding of how we may manipulate organisms. Then show you why we can't do it yet properly. And then try to finish by showing you what we would have to do in order to be able to do it. I hope that went over in Spanish. However, well, let us just see what are the essential features of the biological revolution as we know it really over the last 30 years. It is a good time to be talking about this because, as some of you may know, this year is the 100th anniversary of the death of Charles Darwin. This year is a Darwin centenary, and it is Darwin who put forward this idea that the way organisms changed in time was because there was variation and natural selection by means of the environment. You may, in one sense, think about the last 100 years of biology as having brought all the mechanisms having brought the explanations for the mechanisms to explain Darwinian natural selection and to understand that. Many people used to think that Darwin's theory was, in fact, a tautology. Just like saying, as Gertrude Stein used to say, a rose is a rose is a rose. That is, the survival of the fittest is nothing more than the survival of the survivors, because what doesn't survive doesn't survive, and there's nothing there to study. So the only thing you have left to study are the survivors, and it's not surprising that they have survived. I mean, in fact, it would be surprising if the survivors had not survived. So we have that situation, but I hope to show that it's much deeper than that, because it presents, as you will see later, one of the still essential puzzles about evolution, which is the explanation of adaptation. I mean, what survives is well adapted. And if it is true that everything has to depend in random fluctuations, random variation, how is it that everything works? Because one of the things we do know is that at a certain level of complexity, it is very difficult to get things to work. Things tend mostly to be a mess. And so how is it that we see about us things that don't fall apart? I mean, you can get up in the morning and your leg doesn't fall off, whereas if it was a motor car, very likely you would have a puncture. It wouldn't work. So how do we get this well-adapted, complex systems? But before we explore that, we must start at a much lower level of organization. And the important thing that we grasp about biology is that when we transmit an organism through time, from one generation to the next, it is not the organism itself which is transmitted, but a representation of the organism that is inside it. That is, we do not transmit the organism itself, but a description of it, or if you like, a program. But I don't want to use the word program, because that has certain meanings that I want to avoid. So I prefer to use the word representation. Inside each and every one of you, there is written on your genes a complete description of you. In fact, it might be argued that there's no point in doing any more biology, because all the explanation is already there. All we have to do is to take out your DNA, work out the sequence by chemical methods, and then stand up and read it. It would be 1,000 million letters, and it would be A, G, C, T, 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 G, C, T, T, 1,000 million times, and as you realize, it would be completely meaningless. However, although that is meaningless at the moment, it is nonetheless true, and that is the problem, that they exist inside each and every one of you and inside each and every animal, a description of the animal written on its genes. And what is transmitted from one generation to the next is this internal representation, and it is the execution or the implementation of that internal representation that then generates the organism. And of course, that is what we are all interested in, the individual organism. But what nature is interested in is the internal representation. How can it be, one may ask, that one can specify within this chemical language this complete description of an organism? It seems absolutely amazing that the fact that our brains are wired up in a particular way so that we can see things when we are born, that all of that is in some way written on the genes. And in order to understand this, because that question we cannot answer yet, we must proceed to much more simple organisms. And the great generation was that the nucleic acid, really largely in simple organisms, or is not entirely true, specified the structure of molecules that were built in another language, namely the language of proteins. So that when the structure of DNA was resolved, the essential problem was formulated, and I will show you what that was. We have here a one-dimensional sequence written in a language of four letters, A, G, C, T, etc., etc., that this corresponded in some way to another linear polymer called the polypeptide chain, and which was a message written in a language of 20 letters, alanine, glycine, leucine, and 20 different ones. Now, of course, you don't find these linear polypeptides working as such in nature. These fold up into very complicated elements called proteins. They present to the world a set of niches, cavities, which can bind various chemicals and which can transform them. And the great simplicity is not the DNA connecting, is not the structure of DNA by itself, in my opinion, but Francis Crick's great idea that you didn't have to specify the three-dimensional structure of a protein. All you had to specify was the one-dimensional sequence, and that contained the information to fold it up. In other words, this sequence here could be thought of as an analog computer which could calculate its own structure. That, known as the sequence hypothesis, is a tremendous simplification, because many people could not see how you could get complex three-dimensional information out of a linear array of such simplicity that it looked completely stupid. And everybody said, how can you make these things without hands? Because everybody had a sculptural view of it. You had to bend the molecule. There are no hands inside the cell. The molecules have a structure, and they can do it by themselves. In other words, given the sequence, the folding will follow automatically. It raises very interesting philosophical questions of why should we go and look for computers to help us to fold this up when perhaps the thing is the best computer of itself? But that raises the question whether you are satisfied with what I've said or you want to know it in a different kind of language. However, so we have the nucleic acid sequence corresponding in some way to the sequence, and this sequence then folding up into a complex structure which did all the work, which displayed the function of the cell. So this is information and this is function. Now, you will realize that that is an enormous, at least to those who saw this at the beginning, it was an enormous enlightenment. Because biochemistry had been preoccupied since the beginning of the century and before with two problems. How is matter transformed in living cells? And how is energy transformed in living cells? They were attempting and succeeded in explaining those two transformations in chemical terms. Because for those of us who were in this field, it was perfectly obvious that all the explanations were finally to be couched in the language of chemistry. And here, for the first time, we could see that we could explain a very difficult issue, such as the transfer of information. We were talking about the transfer of information in biological systems, that too could be explained in chemical terms, simply because one had a correspondence between a one-dimensional two one-dimensional sequences plus the capacity of this to present a function. In other words, when I say to someone, you know, it is possible to implement a mathematical expression in a DNA sequence. For example, the number 5 times 10 to the minus 6, that is 5 millionths, can actually be represented in this sequence. People say that sounds ridiculous, but let me show you how to do it. See, 5 times 10 to the minus 6 is a number, but I can imagine, let us say, an enzyme with an affinity constant of 5 times 10 to the minus 6 molar. That is, it will bind a molecule with an energy that will give you that kind of affinity and which will be expressed in that number. Therefore, if I want to specify that number in nature, all I have to do is to build an enzyme, which I can do by writing down the sequence and making the enzyme, and build this enzyme so that there is a niche on it, and that will have an affinity in terms of its function of that number. But you need all of this intermediary, and you need the two calculations, so to speak, if I can use them, namely the genetic material which has to calculate the sequence, or, putting it in another way, the genetic material which has to be interpreted into the sequence, and this sequence which then has to be interpreted by a rather different process into the structure of a protein molecule. All right. Now, having got that idea, which was a tremendous penetration, we may now begin to understand how it is possible to specify a function in terms of a nucleic acid inside a cell. Let me now just take up another topic which is important to understand at the beginning. Let me draw you a little picture of a bacterium. That's a bacterium. That's E. coli. I know you don't believe it, but it is. Let's draw its dimensions. It's about 1 micron long. 1 micron is 1 millionth of a meter, or 1,000th of a millimeter long. Right? This bacterium has DNA in it. The DNA is drawn like this sometimes. It's a circle. Turns out to be a circular molecule. But that's completely wrong, because that DNA for this E. coli, this one bacterium, is 1 millimeter in length. All right? You can't see it, even though it's so long. The trouble is that it's very thin. It's only 20 angstrom units thick. All right? It used to be said that if you took all the DNA in one human being and stretched it end to end, it would go several times from here to the sun and back. And of course you would think, well, why can't you see the DNA? Of course, that says that in one sense you are very fat, but in the other sense the DNA is extremely thin and it can fit into the bacterium like this. So imagine this DNA inside this bacterium, it's 1,000 times the dimensions. That means it must be packed many times, folded backwards and forwards. Let us ask, how many elementary units are in that 1 millimeter? It turns out that of these nucleotides or nucleotides pairs, 3 times 10 to the 6, 3 million of these inside this bacterium. All right, now, we know from this previous thing that for each of these elements on this DNA, 3 of these, a triplet, corresponds to one amino acid. So, we could make for every 3 of these, we could make we could make a million amino acids. Of course, unlike the DNA, they're not just strung end to end, they're all separate molecules. So let's just ask, what is an average protein, an average enzyme? I will tell you that the average enzyme is 333 amino acids. That, as you can see, is very convenient, because if I multiply that by 3, the average gene to make the average protein is 1,000 nucleotide pairs. All right? So now I can calculate from this how many genes E. coli has. All right? These are genes, we could call them naive molecular biologist genes. Molecular biologists don't know very much. They're very simple people. They've said, well, we know 3 nucleotides is 1 amino acid. You could make a decent enzyme, 35,000 molecular weight from 1,000 nucleotide pairs. So let's calculate how many genes has E. coli got. You can all do this here. E. coli, according to this, has 3,000 genes. All right, so there are 3,000 different products in this space. Okay, now, let's just, all right. It turns out this is not a bad number. It's probably close to that. It might be 2,000. It won't be 4,000, I can promise you that. You know, people always, it's very interesting, this whole question. People are always saying, do organisms have too much DNA, you see? And there are always three classes of people. First of all, there are people who are very theological, and they say, well, there are people who feel that organisms can't have enough DNA. I mean, to specify them, there must be something else. So they have ideas that there must be a soul or a vital spirit. So one class of people believe that organisms don't have enough DNA. There's another class of people, like physicists, who believe that organisms have too much DNA. And whenever I'm asked, I say, well, organisms probably have just the right amount, almost the right amount to make them. So, here we are, we have E. coli, 3,000 genes, 3,000 enzymes. Let's say that is correct. All inside this one space, 1 micron by 0.5 micron. 3,000 different chemical functions all going on here. They have to be doubled every 20 minutes. This has to divide into 2 every 20 minutes. This DNA has to be copied. It has to be separated every 20 minutes. If you give this problem to a mathematician, an applied mathematician, and say give it to him in the form of a factory which has 3,000 independent machines, and just tell him that this thing doesn't break down very often, he says it's totally impossible. Such things cannot work. They will blow up. Now, why can't they work? All right, let me just try and explain. This is very important, because on this depends a lot. If we were to design a factory with 3,000 processes in it, I'll tell you the way we do it as human beings. We say we need a control system. All right, so we say we have to have a computer here, and we give it a name. We call it the supervisor or the monitor. Okay. Or in Spanish, el jefe. Okay. All right. Now, this thing has got certain power to calculate. There are 3,000 things going on here. I'll just draw some of them. Lots of them. So it's got to get some information from these. So we have to have a wire with a probe goes into that one, goes into that one, goes into this one. All right? And so on. Each one of these. Now, these are not allowed any independence. All they will say to El Jefe is, it's hot here, or there's not enough food. And El Jefe then will calculate and say, faster or slower, all right? And if you try to do this, this is great problems here in optimization, they will tell you, you'll never get it to work because this supervisor will strangle itself. It will be so busy administering itself as to whose message will it receive that it won't be able to do any work. It'll not have enough computation power. So you ask yourself, how does a bacterium actually work? I mean, how is it that it can do this? Is there a master control? And I'll tell you, the great news is there's no master control. Right? What there is the following. It is an anarchy. All of these are demons, as we would call them, devils. The thing that is, they do what they like. There are subsets of these which are bound together. But the regime is extremely strict. If you overstep the mark, then you are killed. Right? So everybody has to optimize. And if anybody is greedy, then the whole thing dies. Because the only thing that is partitioned is the resource. Right? Now we know this. It's called distributed control. There's no central control. So this doesn't exist anywhere. And, of course, you can imagine that many people have thought of this for more complicated things like development. But clearly it's ridiculous because, I mean, if you imagine yourself developing and you are growing your toes then and you have your big toe, I mean, where does the big toe report to and say, boss, I'm this size, what do I do now? You see? And it's just ridiculous. I mean, the big toe had better look after itself. And so we have distributed control. Now, because there's no control, and because this does not need any mathematics beyond arithmetic, right? There's no Pontryagin topological optimization here. There are no limit cycles. There's nothing here except a history of discipline. Then it is very easy to add another thing. Now, why is this, sir? Well, let me just show you this. I have an enzyme here. Let us suppose I have three enzymes. And they do the transformations of A to B to C and so on. So that this binds A and transforms it into B, and this binds B and transforms it in this way. Now, many of us think this can only be done if this enzyme takes this A and gives it to this one directly with a pipe or a hand. This is known as the Detroit model. This is the way you build motor cars. You have a thing here, you have assembly line, then you put another thing on. It's not the way biological systems work. This A is thrown out, all right? And it moves around in the cell. And it doesn't know how to find the next enzyme. It bangs against everything. Occasionally, by chance, it will bang against the right group. Then it sticks. This is known in information terms a broadcast system. That is, you have no wiring problems. In a normal computer, you have to wire one place to another because everything has a physical address. If you want to go from one place to another, you must send it down a wire. You have no wires here. Or put in another way, everything is wired up to everything else, but very few of the wires count. So this A is thrown out. This A can bumble around. If it hits the B in the wrong place, it hits something else, it's ignored. Only when it's relevant will it be worked on. It's the secret of the affinity site. Now, that may sound very inefficient, but it turns out that at this scale, it is extremely efficient. And let me give you a number. A single molecule of the sort that we have in these biological systems like ATP, say molecular weight 500, will cross this bacterial cell in a millisecond, which means in 1 second it has been everywhere just by chance diffusion. So on this scale, diffusion is enough to make everything everywhere. The affinity site is enough to make things very specific, and so we don't need any wires. Now, it means then that there has to be no one to calculate that when an enzyme has to say, now let me see, do I have to worry about, let's see, I'm glucose, but tryptophan, pH, histidine, another, it just doesn't know anything about this. Stupidity here becomes very important. It is sometimes much more important to be naturally stupid than to be artificially intelligent. Very well. Now, it is this feature here that allows us to accomplish the first stages of what is called genetic engineering. That is, inside a bacterium, it is very easy to infiltrate another function. As long as it doesn't demand too much of the resource of energy or material, it will be ignored. Right? Because there is no complicated system in which it has to find itself. It is possible then, as many of you know, to take smaller bits of DNA, which also occur in bacteria, called plasmids. These are not 1 millimeter. They are a few microns in size. We can purify these, and we can then cut them with various methods, and we can add to them, this is called gene cloning, other sequences which will be expressed in this bacterium. And we have ways of putting it back. Right. Now, of course, let us take an example. Suppose I want some duck DNA in E. coli. That's the first stage. First you have duck DNA, then you have orange DNA. You put that in E. coli. So I can easily do this. I can take a duck, I can cut its DNA, and I can infiltrate it into one of these little plasmids, and I can put it into E. coli. Now you may ask, doesn't the E. coli say, that's duck DNA, I have nothing to do with ducks, and I will reject it? The answer is no. There is nothing on DNA, to a first approximation, that E. coli can recognize as being just peculiarly E. coli DNA, rather than duck or orange or any other DNA. And that is because the value of this DNA is in large measure, not entirely, but in large measure, tested by having to go through this interpretation process that I mentioned. I mean, it is this product that we can tell is a duck product. But this sequence is just any old DNA. And E. coli will copy it, and if it's got the right signals, it will express it, and it won't know whether that's one of its own genes, or a duck gene, or interferon, or growth hormone, or any one of the other things that many people have cloned. Therefore, it is easy to argue that we can infiltrate an additional function into a bacterium because of the nature of its control mechanism. It consists of a set of parallel demons operating in ignorance of each other, and as long as our new gene is not too greedy, then it will survive there and it will make a product. And of course that is what most of you and most of the public understand by genetic engineering. But what I want to go on to now is to talk about real genetic engineering. You see, for many years I had the ambition to be the first professor of mythological biology, because it could be asked, do we have now the chance to make animals that have never been made before. I don't know whether you have the thing in Spanish, a centaur, which the Greeks invented, but when you think about how a Greek made a centaur, he cut off a man about here, and he glued him on top of a horse, and that he called a centaur. Now, let's just see what that means. I apologize, so this will be a very funny centaur, but basically, the centaur has some rear legs, okay, and this outer part I'm not very good at, but okay, you see, and there is this man. Quite often he had a beard, yeah. Now, but the important thing is he has six limbs. When you think about it, you see, there's one pair of lungs in there, inside. And there's another pair over here from the horse. Now, the horse's thorax isn't where its neck is. Think about it. This man has a stomach inside here, and the horse has another one inside here. So there are many anatomical problems to make centaurs. However, let us suppose that it was possible. Let us suppose that it was possible. Yes. To that such a thing was anatomical. Yeah, is that better? Yes. We have to make this by changing the genes. So when you go to a place and say you would like a centaur to keep in your back garden, you ask the man not to get hold of someone else and a horse and cut this and stick it together, but you ask him to design the genetic material to make a centaur. That would be a real genetic engineer, you see, because engineering consists of the concept of design. People do not build bridges, although sometimes it looks by just trying, you know, put up something. If it works, it works. They use physics. Sometimes it doesn't work, I know. But still, the concept of design is that you take general principles and you actually have in the brain of a man the application of these general principles to some construct of the future. If we want to do genetic engineering, we have to be able to do the same thing. We have to be able to say, well, we will take this gene and that gene, we will graft it in these places, and then that will make a centaur. Also, that centaur, we will make man centaurs and lady centaurs, and then you could have little centaurs from that, because that would be the art of genetic engineering. Not just to make one thing in which the man might fall off one day because of transplantation rejection. All right, and this we come now to the core issue, which I have said in a somewhat humorous way, but I think it conceals a very deep truth. Genetic engineering now requires us, or the demand to do this, whether it is that we wish to transform plants or animals or ourselves for that matter, although I think that's very unlikely, we need more knowledge. The knowledge that we have in molecular biology and in cellular biology has allowed us to do alteration of organisms such as E. coli, in which we can simply add or take away a few elementary functions, because most of E. coli is elementary function. And it has a structural design and an organizational design that permits this. Now, All through this time, I have been talking about something that remains the great challenge of biology. I said earlier that we had faced a situation in biology with the beginnings of molecular biology, where biochemistry had led to the understanding of the transformation of matter and energy inside living things. Classical molecular biology has led to the understanding of the transformation of information in chemical terms. What we want to understand now is how something that we can only call organization is implemented in molecular and chemical terms. Now, this is going to require a whole set of new concepts, of which I have tried to suggest a few. You see, I have given you a computational model of the bacterial cell. I have said that it is parallel, there's no control structure. Let me give you finally, in connection with this, another example, which will lead you to see how we have to deal with this. If you take a bacterial virus, this is an extremely accurately specified geometrical structure in which we have many components joined together. You have a hexagonal head, a tail, many things sticking out of the tail like this. And if you look at these, they are extremely homogeneous elements. In some strong sense, we could say that this geometry is genetically specified. That is, somewhere inside the internal representation of this virus, there is written a description of that angle and how many subunits we have here, that length, right? And that angle there, because it is angles and lengths that will specify this geometry. And the question is how is it represented? Now, I'll tell you how it's represented. And you could not understand how it's represented until you grasp another principle. And that is the principle of self-assembly, right? Because the way this head is formed is that it is made out of 1,200 identical protein molecules which aggregate together into giving you the structure. How do they do this? Each protein molecule will see a thing and bond with it. And it will bond with it and with others in a particular pattern. Right? That means that to specify this head, we must specify this interaction, we must specify this bonding symmetry. That means somewhere we have to write on the surface of these molecules the sequences of amino acids that are going to interact. And then when we have this and the energetic constraints, that will do this. And the same is true for all the other bits. And so that means if I unwind the whole DNA of this virus and I understand all of this in detail, then I can point to where this geometry is specified and it's distributed. It's a little bit here, it's a little bit there, it's a little bit somewhere else. And I couldn't understand that by just reading it off the DNA, because I would actually have to understand self-assembly, I would have to understand this principle of organization. Of course, even at this elementary level, for viruses and for molecular entities, that is an enormous task. And of course, what we are asking for organisms as complicated as ourselves to understand the chemical implementation of organization, where the subunits are not molecules or pieces or atoms, but cells and the interaction between cells and tissues and organs. Well, I was going to say a little more, but I think I have outdistanced my time. And I would therefore like to summarize these views that I have put here in the following form. First, I think you can see that the new biology is only dawning now. Many people will say that there's no more science to be done. It's all finished, and it's all totally boring and uninteresting, and we know everything. I think you should be clear that we know very little so far as many of these more complex problems. We know, I think, how to manipulate bacteria with a few elementary functions. But the idea of manipulating very complex structures made of many cells, that, I think, will still take a long time. We will have to, I think, learn a lot about how complex organisms are built. So we'll have to learn a lot about that. We will have to learn, we will somehow have to get a language to talk about organization in general. We will have to try to grasp what it takes to grasp when we think of many things happening at the same time. This is where we humans are very poor. If you have a thing in which many things are going on simultaneously in parallel, our ordinary language, which is serial in time, finds it very difficult to talk about saying, well, while this is going on and while this is going on and this is going on, we prefer many things that we prefer serial events, sequential events, which are very narrow rather than broad. So we will have to learn, I think, a new way of describing and discussing problems of organization and in order to understand how these have been implemented in the biological world, and before we would be able to manipulate it. Some of you may have read in the newspapers that the famous English astronomer Fred Hoyle now believes evolution is impossible and has about the same probability of happening. He thinks that there is about the same probability of getting a bacterium as there would be a scrap heap of metal spontaneously assembling into a Boeing 747 and flying away. Well, of course, I believe that if that were the way biological systems worked, that would be a miracle. And I've told Hoyle that if I were to disassemble him into his elementary particles of protons, pi mesons, and neutrons, and if it were true that they would spontaneously reassemble into Hoyle, including the suit he was wearing and the tie and so on, I would be enormously surprised. I think you would as well. In fact, I would begin to believe in miracles at that point. The thing is this, that what I'm driving at is that's not the way biological organisms are made. They do not come from the condensation of elementary particles into objects like this. We have a very particular part of nature to deal with, a very particular part which is characterized by a unique system in that the complexity of the final product is represented ultimately in a very simple physical form, namely a sequence of nucleotide bases. That simple form has to be translated, interpreted through a very complex machinery into the final form of the organism. Therefore, the central problem of complex organisms is the problem of construction. First, the problem of natural construction. That is, we would like to know what it is you have to do to make a hand. All right? And it's now you're saying you make a hand by making five fingers and then sticking them on like this. Right? That's not the way hands are made. We have to try to understand that in terms of the actual construction of the hand itself. And we have to ask questions of how do the genes participate in specifying this? When we begin to understand that, then I think we can really begin to discuss whether genetic engineering is possible. At the moment, what we do is we close our eyes and we hit something, roughly speaking, and if it works, it works. But you see, that is nature's way of doing it. Nature has worked by trial and error, simply by having genetic variation and then allowing natural selection to occur. And I'd like to finish off with a story which I'm very proud to say I have invented myself. And it's about Francis Crick, with whom, as you heard, I shared an office for many years. About 1970s, Francis Crick got very interested in developmental biology, and he began to study Drosophila. And as you know, Drosophila is built like a Volkswagen. You have each of the parts made separately from imaginal discs, and then they're all just nailed together like this. And of course, it's these imaginal discs, at least this is the body part of the animal, is very important to try and understand how each one can give rise to a particular part of the outside of the animal. And one day, Francis was sitting in the office, and he said, God knows how these imaginal discs work. Of course, he said it in frustration. And then I had this picture of Francis Crick ultimately going to heaven and arriving in heaven and the angel welcoming him in and saying, please have a drink, relax here. And he's saying, no, 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 I want to meet God and I want to ask him a question. And they say, no, 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 have a rest, there's plenty of time. He said, no, 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 take me to see him. So they take him through the front part of heaven, which is beautiful buildings. They go through the middle part of heaven, which is not so good. And finally they come right to the back part of heaven, on the other side of the railway line, where there's this terrible corrugated iron shed. And it's very dark inside, and they go in, and there is a little man in overalls with a big spanner in his back pocket. And the angel says, Dr. Crick, this is God. God, this is Dr. Crick. And Francis then says, oh, how wonderful to meet you. Now I can ask you the question. How do the imaginal discs of Drosophila work? And God says, well, he said, We took a little bit of this, and we sort of stuck it to this. He says, we don't know how they work, but we've been building flies for hundreds of millions of years, and we've had no complaints. Thank you very much.